This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the White House and Republican leaders seem to be singing much the same song on the so-called fiscal cliff. The deplorable state of human rights under foreign occupation in Haiti. And who's to blame for the death of millions in Congo? The high crimes of Bill Clinton.
But first, Benton Harbor, Michigan political activist Reverend Edward Pinckney has organized a campaign for NAACP members to show their dissatisfaction with the organization by burning their membership cards. Pinckney was a longtime leader of the NAACP. We asked him how many NAACP cards have been turned into ashes so far.
Well, right now we are closer to 3,000 than we ever been. We had 2,974 cards, and we usually round it off to an even 3,000. Every Sunday at 5:30, we have our card burning of the NAACP cards, and we call it Burn, Baby, Burn. That's the name of it.
And why does the NAACP deserve to have those precious cards burned?
Well, to begin with, one of the things that has happened here is that as president of the NAACP, there was a hostile takeover by Whirlpool Corporation. And what happened was they went and met. They sent the vice president of Whirlpool Corporation, and some of the individuals around here went and met with the state NAACP. And they told the state NAACP that they wanted to support the NAACP, but they would not support the NAACP under Reverend Pinckney leadership, because we had called for a boycott of all Whirlpool products. And we have been pounding them for the last 6 months. So they decided that they were going to neutralize Reverend Pinckney by going to the state and tell them that if you get rid of Pinckney, we'll support you financially.
And how did the state NAACP respond to that overture from Whirlpool?
Well, the first thing they did, they came out and lied on our branch, said we had not had a meeting in 6 months. And we have two meetings every month. So they couldn't, once we produced the minutes, they had to eat those words. Then they came back and said that we didn't have an election. Then they found out we had an election. So then what they tried to do was say that this branch no longer exists, and they tried to sneak in and have an election. And here's the deal. I took them to court, and I sued them for $100,000. And the judge looked at the suit, he kind of like threw out my $100,000. But he said that, we basically said that if I file my complaint with Ben Jealous, and he don't look at it the way it should be looked at, pretty much in my favor, then he was going to rule and put my $100,000 back on the table. So what happened was, Ben Jealous went on maternity leave. When he went on maternity leave, I don't know whether he told them to do this, I can't say, but he never answered my complaint. And then they had an election. They gave people a week notice, and they had an election that following Thursday. But I didn't receive a notice, but everybody else did. And they had the election on a Thursday. They received the notice on a Saturday, and that Thursday they had an election, and I wasn't allowed to go in. Matter of fact, they had armed guards at the door. The police department was there to keep me from coming on the premises at the NAACP election. And in order to get in, you had to have a picture ID, and you couldn't vote unless you had a picture ID. And this is one of the things that they were allocated all around the country, that it was illegal to require somebody to have a picture ID. But yet and still, they wanted anybody who came in, they had to have a picture ID. So, by them not allowing me to come, because they were still afraid, that I might win. Whirlpool had went out and purchased 350 memberships. And the bad part, Whirlpool put it on their website that if you want to become a member of the NAACP, contact Marcus Robinson, who was not even a member of the NAACP at that time. So basically, I decided that we're going to start making them put up or shut up. And we're talking about the inaction of the NAACP and their action. So we're trying to change the flavor now of what's happening here and also with the NAACP. So on February the 1st, 2013, we are going to be in Hollywood, California, and we are going to picket the Image Awards. And we're preparing people from all over the country to come. So far, I have got commitments from several hundred people who say that they will be there.
Now, where are these almost 3,000 people who have sent in their cards for you to burn? Where do they come from? Certainly not all from Benton Harbor.
No, absolutely not. From all over the country. They've been calling me, sending me their cards. If they didn't send it, they'll send me an email saying, well, we have 10 people who are going to burn their cards at 5:30 on Sunday. And it's been going on for about almost 2 months now. Maybe a little bit longer, but our main objective is to wake up the NAACP. Let them know that people know now that you're not for our people and you're out of touch with our community. So we want to bring that back, to just revert them back to where we were and teach them that if you say you're going to do something, let's do it.
3,000 people sounds like the beginnings of the start of a counter-NAACP, or an NAACP that is truer to the ideals that brought you to the NAACP.
Absolutely. And we got a little group that usually have a phone conference every Thursday night. And what we do is that we call ourselves the African American for Justice for All. That includes the people inside the community who need help. And they can always count on us. And we're growing. We have maybe right now maybe 75 to 100 people across the country that also is part of this little group.
When you go to the Image Awards, you won't be just talking about the particular grievance that you have in Benton Harbor.
Absolutely. We will definitely not. As a matter of fact, we're going to be talking about issues that are occurring all across the country. Some of the things that they're doing or they're not doing and should be doing. And when you say that you're a civil rights organization, we expect you to be a civil rights organization. We need you to start standing up for our community. We need you to stop taking these corporate dollars and being misled and then got the people thinking that you're doing something for us. One of the things that happened to me, it was this guy out of Seattle. He called me to chew me out about the NAACP. He said the NAACP is the oldest civil rights organization in the world who have stood up. I mean, he went on for about 10 minutes, tearing me up. Then finally I told him, I said they were. They were once was the greatest civil rights organization that was 50 years ago. They have done exactly nothing in the last 50 years. And then I showed him a list. I had this list that I emailed to him, showing him of the 50 names that Whirlpool had purchased membership to overthrow this brand so they can take control of it. And what he did, he burned his NAACP card. He had his wife to burn his NAACP card. His son's wife, he said he wants everybody in his family to burn the NAACP card simply because I had the evidence to support what I'm saying instead of just running off at the mouth.
And so I guess you have somebody working with your new organization.
Absolutely, man. He's going to be in Hollywood, California, February the 1st, him and his family. One of the things that we have to learn, we have to hold these people accountable. We do not hold people accountable. Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, and Ben Jellison, the NAACP, whatever they say, we let it go. They say, oh, those are our leaders. Those are not our leaders. They're leading blacks. That's what they're doing. As long as we stay silent, they're going to continue doing what they're doing. So now is the time for us to step to the plate and do the things that need to be done.
Reverend Edward Pinckney in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
The Democratic White House and Republican congressional leaders sound very much alike as they beat the drums about the so-called fiscal cliff. We spoke with David Swanson of the influential website War is a Crime. Are President Obama and the Republicans playing tag team?
Well, clearly they are. They both are hyping the same pretense, the same premise that we are headed towards this fiscal cliff. They've both framed the problem in identical terms, and they're discussing a grand bargain, a bargain between the two parties, not the rest of us, of course, that will solve the problem. So you don't really have opposition between these two parties. You have agreement that when these tax cuts expire, and when Medicare and Medicaid cost a little bit more money, and when we come to the end of this fiscal year and so forth, we are up against catastrophe, you know. And of course, we're not up against catastrophe when we eliminate the estate tax or when we fight trillion-dollar wars or when we bail out Wall Street. You know, we don't hear this kind of talk. But they're framing it this way, and they're pushing essentially the same solutions. They want to go after Medicare and Medicaid. They want to go after other non-military spending. Nobody on either side is talking about the military budget. Nobody on either side is talking about serious taxation of billionaires. In fact, both sides are talking about cutting corporate taxes. I mean, it's a question of degree here as to getting to this grand bargain.
And it seems like a grand bargain that does not include at least half of the Democratic Party, at least that half of the Democratic Party that has never spoken like this before.
Well, you're going to have the more progressive Democrats in Congress and the progressive outside but loyal to the Democratic Party groups pushing back, and they're pushing back in various ways. You know, the progressive Democrats of America is going and lobbying Republicans and Democrats alike, to their credit, but they're still labeling themselves Democrats, come hell or high water. The MoveOn.orgs of the world are organizing protests in Republican districts and framing the concern over the evil of the Republicans entirely as if the other side of the bargain has no place to play. And so essentially telegraphing the message that whatever comes down, as long as the Democratic Party is okay with it, so will we be. And all that they're asking for, all that these dozens and dozens of liberal groups and progressive groups and labor unions, with very few exceptions, what they're asking for does not mention the military budget, does not mention where all the money is going, over $1 trillion every year into that hole of preparing for wars, and does not mention proposals for serious, serious taxation of billionaires and corporations and estates and financial transactions and capital gains. It's all about avoiding cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And even Obama, to his credit, at least at this point, is not proposing to cut Social Security, but is ready to go after Medicare and Medicaid. And it's all about the Bush tax cuts, which we still call the Bush tax cuts, even though the Obama administration oversaw their continuation a couple of years back. And when you listen to Obama talk, and when you listen to his senior advisors like David Plouffe talk, their great fear is over those tax cuts expiring. They'd really, really like to see them expire for the richest among us, but if they expire for everybody, we're doomed. And so you do not get it. At President Obama's first press conference after the election, you did not get a strong commitment from him not to cave again on insisting that those tax cuts end for the wealthy. So don't be shocked if they continue.
And so the untouchable item is not Social Security, it's defense.
Indeed, so-called. I don't call it defense because it has nothing to do with defending anybody. In fact, it makes us less safe. And it's very hard to explain to people that military spending makes us less safe because, of course, it's called defense. But it's over $1 trillion a year through various departments, including the so-called Defense Department, and it is building incredible hostility in places like Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia. It is the most wasteful, the least overseen, the most corrupted, and the most harmful form of spending in economic terms alone, never mind foreign relations and morality. And yet it's untouchable. Neither of these parties will talk about it. The corporate media won't talk about it. And the liberal groups that are demanding a more progressive approach to our budgetary priorities won't mention the greater share, over half, of the federal budget.
Well, maybe these liberals feel that if they simply don't fight over military spending, they won't look like they're getting their butts kicked so badly.
Yes, I think there's always this strategy of finding out what's likely to happen and then campaigning for it so that you can then claim a victory and go to your funders and say, look what we did, and brag to each other and continue to go to meetings at the White House and on Capitol Hill with the people that you lobbied to do what they already wanted you to lobby them to do. But I think it's very, very bad strategy. And it's why I told people during the election to vote for Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson, not because I thought Jill Stein was going to win. But because once the election was over, I didn't want people to keep acting like they were on the team of the Democratic Party. I wanted them to begin acting like citizens. And to some extent, we're beginning to see that. But it's very limited. And it's limited by this lesser evil thinking that continues year in, year out, no longer justified by this rational electoral calculation on election day.
Yeah, we see so many of these people who call themselves progressives talking about, we won on election day. What did they win?
Yeah, in fact, I'm getting emails from people like Move On saying, didn't we win? Hey, didn't we just win an election? Well, of course, we didn't, unless we've identified ourselves with certain candidates, candidates who most people voted for because they saw other candidates as even more evil. And there's this danger in identifying ourselves that way with a candidate. Certainly, you could say the Democrats won, or the Democrats won at least in certain races and in the presidential race, and therefore they shouldn't be acting like they lost. But in fact, Democrats always, in this frame of thinking, act as if they lost because they act on the interests of their corporate funders that people blind themselves to as they cheer for their candidates at election time. So we have to get over the idea that anything substantive is won for the people or for peace or for justice in an election and begin pushing for what we want now without the self-censorship, because there's not an election anytime soon.
David Swanson speaking from Charlottesville, Virginia.
President Obama is preparing to shuffle his cabinet as he enters his second term in office. One man that many progressives hope will get his walk-in papers is Arnie Duncan, the Secretary of Education. Dr. Sam Anderson of New York City's Independent Commission on Public Education says the Obama administration has been very bad news for the public schools.
The privatization of public education has really taken off in the past 4 years on many different levels. The race to the top monies, which were billions of dollars, had as part of its stipulation, you have to have more charter schools in order to get some of this money. You have to have mayoral control, or working towards mayoral control of the public school system. You have to have high-stakes testing as the center for not only evaluating the student, but also evaluating the teacher. And that whole process turns out to be absolutely anti-union. The charter school, the high-stakes testing, two focal points on the anti-union approach to teachers and education. So it really took off under the Obama administration, and Wall Street loves it. The hedge funders are now able to tap into the $1.2 trillion education trough, and that's exactly what they're doing.
One of the things we've observed over the last 4 years is that with the attack on public education coming from Democratic ranks, it's introduced a profound confusion among the traditional defenders of public education, who tend to be Democrats.
Absolutely right. And what also compounds it is that you have a black president who is part of that Democratic Party process. So we are in a very, very terrible position. We, meaning the progressive educators, and particularly the black and Latino educators in this country, who see the need for radical educational changes in the structure of public education, K through 16, we're in a weak position and have to reconsolidate quickly, or else we will have lost a excellent moment, this moment now, this transitory period between December and February, pushing forward a more progressive person to head up the United States Department of Education. Not necessarily having, they may not be put into position, but it's a way of educating and highlighting to the masses of people that this problem of public education, this crisis in public education, is not just a local issue in your school or your city. It's something that is determined and designed from the top down, from the president's office down. And so that's where we are at this point in terms of trying to pull some action together.
And so we need some common language for this discussion. Back in the day, one of the watchwords of progressive black education was community control. What you're talking about is a kind of new watchword under the rubric of human rights.
Right, which also incorporates what we call neighborhood school control or community control version 2. One of the things that we do in this period is to point out, once again, and it's nothing new within the black community, that education is a human right. That is something historically rooted in our struggle to be free in this country and as black people. We were the first to introduce public education and introduce it as a human right in the 1700s, when the black churches in Philadelphia and New York opened their doors to children to be taught. They took in everybody. They took in the black children and the white children, the enslaved black children or the so-called free black children and the poor white children, in to teach them. And that's a legacy that's deeply embedded in the struggle for black education. So it's a no-brainer for our community to see education as a human right. And to manifest that, we go back to the struggles, some of the tactics that were developed in the 60s to manifest that education as a human right, to make that real. We say that we do that in our communities, that we have the power, we have the expertise, we have the parents, we have the students, we have the teachers coming, emanating out of our community, and we're going to define the process of public education from the communities on the grounded in education as a human right. The second part of this is that education as a human right is a global concept on the planet Earth, and that there have been all kinds of United Nations decrees and world conferences and all that kind of stuff happening all over the world for the past 35, 40 years around the issue of education as a human right. And that, in other words, when ordinary black folks see that the rest of the world embraces this notion and has struggled to make that a reality in their respective countries, then they see themselves as not being alone, and they see that the United States government is colluding with the big business to make sure that our children are miseducated so that they can have fodder for their wars and fodder for their prisons and for their McDonald's jobs if they ever get a job. So we lay that out. And the third aspect of that is in terms of transforming, radically transforming the curriculum. We say that the curriculum, we have to look at black educational and cultural excellence in the curriculum. We have to tell the truth about culture and history of the world and the United States. And when you tell the truth about it, then you are infusing the history of black folk as being central to the development of the societies in the Western Hemisphere. You are infusing that into the curriculum. You're also infusing the cultural realities of the foundations of math and science coming out of non-European roots. All of those kind of things will help raise the consciousness and self-confidence of our children, and which is not being done now. For example, we have less black history being taught now in the public schools in the United States than 40 years ago. We have less of our children being interested in becoming intellectually developed than ever before. It is hip to be dumb. It is hip not to read. It is hip to not to know your history. And we want to reverse that. And the ways we can do that is through this whole holistic approach to fighting against the privatization aspects that are being mandated by state and federal mandates around Common Core state standards, Race to the Top, No Child Left Behind, you name it. You know, it's out there. That's our challenge, to critique those things and offer an alternative.
So we're seeking education for liberation.
Education for liberation, exactly. I love to always quote Frederick Douglass when he said, "We struggle to learn to struggle." And that should be our motto.
One of the most noteworthy things about the Chicago strike was the high profile of community control and the participation of parents, particularly right. Black parents in Chicago. And that, of course, is the backyard of our nemesis, Arne Duncan.
Right, exactly. The great work that the Chicago Teachers Union did over roughly a two-year period of constantly informing the community about what the real issues are around public education really helped to get that solidarity, to get that concrete support in the Chicago communities around their strike. And that has now continued on, where the communities, particularly the Black and Latino communities, are fighting against the closing of traditional public schools and the opening of charter schools everywhere. They're fighting that. There's an organized pushback in Chicago against that. And that's another on-the-ground kind of battle that the progressive forces need to intervene in, and they need to be part of that effort. The Black progressive educators and so forth, community organizers, you name them, they need to be engaged in that.
That was Dr. Sam Anderson of the Independent Commission on Public Education speaking from New York.
The so-called Congolese rebel group, M23, is giving mixed signals about pulling out of Goma, the eastern Congolese city they captured last month. Upwards of 6 million people have died since 1996, when Congo's neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda, invaded the country, virtually annexing the eastern provinces of North and South Kivu. That's where much of Congo's vast mineral wealth is located. Last week, the Congo Coalition staged a demonstration to highlight the Holocaust in Congo. We asked Coalition leader Professor Ya Lengi, who is most to blame for the Congolese genocide?
Bill Clinton, it was his administration that started all of this in 1996, you might remember. And so from 1996 until 2008, when Obama became president, all those years, it was Bill Clinton and, by the way, Susan Rice and even Johnny Carson, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. All of these people worked for Bill Clinton. So therefore, we put this squarely in the beginning with Bill Clinton. However, what we recognize is that the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, has been taking policies that were, as you said, supportive of Rwanda. In fact, in a few times, the White House, Obama himself, has had to veto Susan Rice's position about the Congo. Because we know Susan Rice is not only very sympathetic to Rwanda, but we understand she even dated the Rwandan Tutsi guy, and she has been going to Rwanda to do some things there. So we know that. But we have seen, because we follow this closely, that he has taken the Obama administration's White House to veto some of the positions Susan Rice has taken in favor of Rwanda. So that's why we try to be a little lenient with Obama himself, but not with some of the stuff that his administration have done. Now, the other thing that I may tell you that is unique is this, that since the beginning of the Congo genocide, which really goes back as far as we are concerned to 1998, which began with the invasion that was sponsored by Bill Clinton in 1996. Since that, there is no government in the world or no head of government in the world that has taken a position in support of the Congo or even trying to come up with a solution to end the genocide in the Congo, except Barack Obama. And this wasn't even when he was president, but when he was a senator. When he was a senator in 2005, under the Bush administration, as a senator, Obama sponsored a bill that became a law, Law 109-456. The law that was signed by President Bush in 2006. This law gives a blueprint not only in stopping the genocide in the Congo, but even in putting together an efficient army that will be able to defend the Congo and drive out those people who have been fomenting atrocities, committing atrocities in the Congo. Now, the problem has been in the application or the putting to work of that law since Obama became president. Some aspects of it we have seen trying to help with the army in the Congo, in eastern Congo, with the United Nations. And lately, with Obama allowing the investigating reports that accuse Rwanda of committing genocide in the Congo. So that's what we have seen happening, and that's why we are not as gung-ho with President Obama himself as far as the Congo is concerned. We are hoping that in this last term that he's going to move strongly forward to end these atrocities. In fact, we have sent him a letter to ask him not to appoint Susan Rice as a Secretary of State because exactly of her position in support of Rwanda and trying to exculpate Paul Kagame, the President of Rwanda. So this is how we analyze the problem of Barack Obama and the Congo genocide.
Now, the M23 group, which people call a rebel group, it's dominated by Tutsis, and the UN report says it's actually controlled by Rwanda and Uganda. But Rwanda and Uganda have actually been in de facto control, virtually annexed the eastern Congo for some years.
That's true. In fact, as far back as 2008, Herman Cohen put it bluntly. He said that the State Department considers the two Kivus part of Rwanda because their economy since 1996 have been 100% integrated into the economy of Rwanda. So that's why when you hear the things like M23 and all these other groups, these are just schemes to try to cover up Rwanda's and Uganda's involvement in eastern Congo. Because without this chaos, without these so-called rebels, without so-called these groups in there, it would be very difficult for Rwanda and Uganda to officially be there and exploiting the resources and controlling all these. But I think the biggest agent that helps Rwanda and Uganda to stay in eastern Congo, and in fact to put together these things like M23 and the other ones, is the president of the Congo, the so-called Joseph Kabila, because he is, according to Rwandans themselves, he used to be in a Rwandan army that invaded the Congo in 1996, and he's also a Tutsi, and that's why you see him go every time there's something in eastern Congo. He goes and meets with Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni, and they'll be laughing. So they're always coming up with schemes to foment this chaos in eastern Congo. So he, so-called Joseph Kabila, whose real name is Hippolyte Kanambe, he is the one that makes sure that the Congolese people never put together a strong army to go and kick Rwanda and Uganda out of eastern Congo. So that's the main thing, or the main person who is actually ensuring for Rwanda and Uganda to stay in eastern Congo. If you look at the map, look how small Rwanda is. I mean, one Kivu is even bigger than Rwanda, let alone the two Kivus together. And both Rwanda and Uganda put together, it's not even one-tenth of the Congo. So in order for them to stay in eastern Congo, they needed to put an agent in the government of Congo. So they put Joseph Kabila as president after they assassinated Laurent Kabila in 2001. So that's how you can explain why this has been going on for so long.
Professor Ya Lengi of the Congo Coalition. William Misezuel was one of the organizers of last week's demonstration. He explained why people are willing to kill millions to keep control of Congo's mineral resources.
To send satellite on space, you need a mineral of the Congo, which they call germanium. to get a plane take off, you need a mineral of the Congo. The cell phones, the laptops, the flat screen TV, all those gadgets, you need the mineral of the Congo. That's why we've seen what's going on today in the Congo. And no media talk about it because they don't want any media to talk about it. Otherwise, the people will know what is going on. That's why we're calling that is the international conspiracy against the Congo.
The Congo Coalition is demanding that former President Bill Clinton apologize to the Congolese people for all the misery he has brought to their country.
In Toronto, Canada, noted historian and author Dr. Gerald Horn discussed the Congo crisis with Ome Salma, a host of Radio Regent's Saturday Morning Live show. Too often, Congo is depicted as a place where Africans kill each other for no reason.
Well, understandably, the North American press basically provides historical context in terms of the devastation inflicted upon Congo some decades ago at the turn of the 20th century when King Leopold of Belgium basically took over this entire country larger than Western Europe as his private preserve and basically exploited the people shamelessly in order to get hold of the vast resources that Congo controls. Not necessarily focused on by the mainstream press in North America is the fact that in the immediate sense, many of Congo's problems accelerated during the time when Ottawa and Washington in particular were backing the kleptomaniacal regime of the soldier, former known as Joseph Mobutu, who ruled Congo after the slaying of Patrice Lumumba in the early 1960s and stayed in power up through the 1990s and basically used that vast country as his own personal playground. And even today, Congo lacks roads, which makes it difficult on the one hand for economic development to take place, but on the other hand makes it difficult for the rebels in eastern Congo to get to the capital, Kinshasa, in the west, because of the dearth of infrastructure and roads in particular. And then, of course, there's the larger geopolitical context, which your prefatory comments reference. That is to say that you have Rwanda backing the M23, according to the United Nations, backed by Uganda. And then you have the Kabila regime in Kinshasa, the capital, which has acceded to the Southern African Development Community, spearheaded by South Africa. And they are basically on the other side of the fence. Now, this brings up echoes of the war that afflicted Congo in the 1990s. It led to millions, yes, millions of deaths. And you may recall that that was a war that saw an intervention by a number of African nations, including Zimbabwe and Angola and Namibia, to mention a few, on behalf of the Kinshasa regime. So that 1990s conflict, we still see ramifications, repercussions of it today in 2012 in terms of what's unfolding in eastern Congo as we speak. Now, you can't really talk about eastern Congo without talking about the vast mineral wealth. Not only the coltan that's embedded in most of the mobile phones that are so readily used in North America and Western Europe and Asia in particular, but of late, there's been an oil discovery, a major oil discovery in Congo, which makes it even more attractive to some. Then another part of the geopolitical context is that there's a basic split in the United Nations Security Council. As you know, there are thousands of peacekeepers dispatched by the UN to eastern Congo, but they're supposed to be keeping the peace, not fighting the M23, and it's been difficult, M23 being the rebel force in eastern Congo, and it's difficult to change their terms of reference because there's a fundamental mistrust and distrust in the Security Council because of the way the Libyan misadventure went down, where the United Nations was told it was all about protecting civilians and it was all about regime change. And so Russia and China in particular feel that the terms of reference for the peacekeepers has changed. This will allow perhaps the United Nations and its allies to do something that Russia and China would not approve of. So all in all, it's a major mess. It's a major disaster that's leading to the killing, quite frankly, of innocent men, women, and children.
In terms of Goma specifically, M23, I mean, I don't know how far this might be true, but said that they were going to leave the area or to leave Goma particularly. What do you see, I guess, in the next couple of weeks or months? What needs to happen?
Well, I think there needs to be more pressure on the United States in particular to basically put pressure on the Rwanda regime and the Ugandan regime, because basically they're the puppeteers. It's well known on the one hand that Rwanda has an understandable fear that Eastern Congo could be used as a launching pad for another kind of genocide by certain so-called Hutu extremists who perpetrated the genocide of April 1994. But Rwanda needs to understand that destabilizing its closest neighbor is not the surest path to domestic tranquility in Rwanda itself. And the Rwandans have to be brought to account. This is very difficult because they're the fair-haired friend of the North Atlantic bloc. It's not only the kinds of foreign aid that pours into Rwanda from governments. You might recall that a British Tory minister just before he resigned some weeks ago, after getting into a tiff in front of 10 Downing Street with a police officer and basically using crude and rude language, he was forced to resign. But right before he resigned, he dispatched millions of dollars in British foreign aid to Rwanda, which is an indication of how the North Atlantic countries feel about this country. And then there's the aid from the philanthropic community, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, one of the largest, if not the largest foundation in the world, pours millions into Rwanda, basically in the field of public health. Ditto for the Doris Duke Foundation, a foundation based on a major tobacco fortune headquartered in New York City. And because of this kind of tie and connection, it basically gives Kigali, it gives the Kagame regime in Kigali, Rwanda, a kind of impunity. An impunity that is leading to a disaster in Eastern Congo.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn speaking on Regent Radio in Toronto. A new report by the International Federation of Human Rights details a wide range of abuses in Haiti, which has been occupied by foreign forces since 2004. Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research says the report gives special emphasis to Haiti's ongoing cholera epidemic.
Unsurprisingly, like many other scientific studies, it finds that the UN troops based in Haiti under MINUSTA were responsible for bringing the cholera bacteria in and causing the epidemic, and points out that the UN has failed to take responsibility for doing that.
And, of course, from a social human rights standpoint, what they're saying is that the United Nations has helped to violate Haitians' human right to clean water.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, of course, it's been part of MINUSTA's mandate going back to 2004 to protect human rights in Haiti. And as you know well, those troops have violated Haitians' rights in various ways, from rape to extrajudicial killing to bringing in this cholera virus. So it's a clear violation not only of human rights, but of their mandate itself.
And the study also had a lot to say about Haiti's security system, calling for a beefing up of its own indigenous security, and they had comments about the prison system as it exists in Haiti.
In many ways, the report concurs with some of the more commonly heard recommendations in terms of Haiti's security and judicial systems, including even what the official position of the U.S. government, which is that the Haitian National Police need to be responsible for policing the country, as opposed to Haitian military, for example, which is what the current Haitian government and Michel Martelly would like, or as opposed to MINUSTA, which is slowly being phased out. The troop numbers there are the lowest they've ever been. It is supposed to be pulled out eventually. So, yeah, the Haitian National Police are supposed to be doing that. Of course, this is common sense, and that Haiti doesn't have any foreign enemies, at least any that it could conceivably take on with the military anyway. And that the Haitian military, of course, originally was set up by the U.S. Army and was only ever used to repress the Haitian people. So it's a recommendation we've seen from groups like the International Crisis Group and Suit for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, among others, you know, groups, by the way, that represent quite a range between them of viewpoints. So it's a pretty common position, yet the Haitian government continues to want to push ahead with an army.
And that is quite interesting. We see an increasing drumbeat of demonstrations demanding more and better police in Haiti, demonstrations from mass organizations, and yet the Haitian U.S.-backed government seems to be intent on reestablishing an army in Haiti.
Yeah, that's right. And it is possible the U.S. government is saying one thing and secretly doing another. We know that there are a number of ex-military and ex-death squad people who have been incorporated back into the Haitian police. So, of course, we would advocate, as have many other groups, that the Haitian police really need to be vetted. They need to weed out these bad apples, if you will, these known human rights violators. They have no place in the police, of course. And, you know, if the international community was serious about helping Haiti and making the police a functional force that actually respected human rights, actually applied the rule of law, including Haiti's own constitution, which, as it's written, is, I would say, very decent in a number of ways regarding human rights, then I think that would solve the problem. But there's really been a lack of will to do that. And as you know, Glenn, the Haitian government is continually sidestepped by the international community. They want to direct funds to just about any place in Haiti except the Haitian government. And so that's been a big part of the ongoing problem there with the security situation, along with almost everything else.
There's some striking statistics in this report about the Haitian prison system. The report says 70% of people in prison in Haiti are there in pretrial detention, and 92% in pretrial detention at the national prison in Port-au-Prince. So it appears that Haitians, among many other human rights, are also denied the right to a speedy trial, or maybe any trial at all.
Yeah, and this is really an ongoing travesty that people who've been looking at human rights in Haiti have known about really for decades. This has been going on. The prisons are chronically overcrowded, and the extent to which people are put in pretrial detention, I mean, you can be completely innocent, just get arrested, false identity or whatever, and be locked up for, you know, possibly years in heavily overcrowded prisons. The report also points out that there have been at least 275 cholera deaths in the prison, you know, in the 2 years since the cholera outbreak started. So that's a really tragic statistic as well. These are people, probably a good number of them, who may not have gotten cholera at all had they not been put in prison in pretrial detention and contracted the disease there, where, of course, safe drinking water is lacking, as the report points out, and sanitation is horrible, and, you know, it's just not conditions in which human beings ought to be living.
Well, let's talk about someone who probably should be in prison, but is not, and that's Baby Doc Duvalier, the former dictator and son of former dictator, who recently returned to Haiti.
Yeah, and so the report finds that this is also a serious shortcoming of the judicial system and its lack of impartiality and independence. That's a quote, that Duvalier continues to walk around free, that he has not been put on trial. It also mentions that the judge who did not want to pursue with the case early this year, after he made that decision, that the attorney pursuing the case against Duvalier, Mario Joseph, of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti and their main partner or sister organization based in Port-au-Prince. He was pursuing that case against Duvalier, and he started to receive death threats at that time. He has received them ever since throughout the year here, and it's been part of a campaign of harassment. There's been graffiti sprayed on the walls of the streets near their offices there in Port-au-Prince. They've been harassed by police. People coming and going from their office have been stopped and interrogated by police. And so this is a clear campaign of harassment against who really is Haiti's most important human rights attorney.
Even the existence and certainly the substance of this human rights report tends to show Haiti as, in fact, a supplicant, a nation without sovereignty.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that becomes quickly apparent to anyone who takes a real honest look at Haiti. Haiti is really, throughout its entire history, really tragically, has been subject to foreign intervention, foreign interference almost continually. And, of course, the main actor currently is the United States. But really, as Noam Chomsky puts them, Haiti's traditional tormentors have been the U.S. And France. And increasingly, we're also seeing Canada take a role in this kind of interference. And so this really does affect most everything, from its lack of economic development to its inability to rebuild after the earthquake, to its inability to successfully fight the cholera. When these are the main foreign actors in the international community directing foreign funds to Haiti, making appeals on Haiti's behalf, and so on and so on, and then that money that is raised is directed to NGOs and bypasses the Haitian government, then the Haitian government is chronically underfunded and does not have capacity to do any of these things, from security to emergency preparedness to responding to these disasters when they happen. So this is really the root, in my opinion, of the biggest problems that Haiti struggles with.
And you're talking about a Haitian government that was itself virtually installed by the United States and elected by only a very small fraction of the people.
Well, that's right, and that's an important point. The current government, President Martelly, was only allowed to come into office because the U.S. interfered, principally the U.S., but a few other countries interfered in the elections and basically forced an overturn of the first round of those elections. And based on no real evidence, it was an arbitrary decision, essentially, and that's how Martelly, a man whose qualifications for the job are questionable at the very best, considering his career has really been that of an entertainer, that's how he got into office. But, you know, my point about the Haitian government being bypassed and systematically weakened by not receiving the support it needs from the international community, that's something that has been ongoing. And even though the current government is doing a number of things that I find frightening and that I find disturbing, I still think that the Haitian government itself needs to be strengthened, it needs to be worked with, it needs capacity building in order to solve some of Haiti's chronic problems. And, you know, when the Martelly leaves office, the next person that takes over needs to take over a government that's in a better position to deal with all these different problems. So this is something that we would like to see, regardless of who's in office in Haiti, is that the Haitian government actually be treated as an equal partner and that it has the capacity to actually start dealing with things on its own.
That was Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. When George Bush's Federal Communication Commission tried to allow big corporations to tighten their grip on radio and television station ownership back in 2003, the move was defeated by a groundswell of popular resistance. Now the Obama administration seems to be up to the same trick. Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
Imagine a U.S. media landscape even more viciously unfair, more drastically tilted to favor greedy, irresponsible, and immensely powerful media corporations than the one we already have. This would be quite a feat of imagination, but the Obama administration's FCC has done it for us and intends to make it real. The Federal Communications Commission is now considering a measure that will remove the few remaining limits on how many radio and TV stations and newspapers giant media companies are allowed to operate in a single market. Apparently, President Obama believes that we need even fewer wealthy corporations to control what we see, hear, and are allowed to broadcast to each other. It's no surprise that broadcast media are not reporting this story. Corporate media never cover stories that reveal the extent of their own vast power and privilege in our supposedly democratic system. What is shocking, however, is that President Obama's FCC commissioner, Julius Genachowski, intends to push this measure through in what amounts to a secret meeting, with little or no chance for public input and not even the least pretense of transparency before this Christmas. Bush's FCC tried the same thing back in 2007. They were stopped by two factors. The first was a federal court ruling that said shrinking the number of companies that own radio stations, TV, and newspapers would lessen the already scant presence of media owners who were women and minorities. The second factor was a firestorm of public disapproval. The American people, left, right, black, brown, and white, simply don't believe that a handful of giant media entities should have even more control over what they see, hear, and can say to each other. It's hard to understand at first glance why the Obama administration would try something this blatantly evil that flies directly in the face of federal court orders and explicitly kicks sand in the faces of many who supported the president in 2008 and 2012. But let's take another look. Suppose the Obama administration convinces a segment of minority media owners to accept some crumbs and withdraw their objection to fewer giant corporations owning more of our media universe. A move like that would take the federal court and minority broadcasters out of the picture, and with them, most of the black and Latino advocacy organizations like the NAACP and the Hispanic broadcasters, who really don't answer to ordinary black and brown people on the street, but who do pay very close attention to what black and brown business people like the minority broadcasters have to say. With the federal court out of the way, most of the traditional advocacy organizations sidelined, and corporate media not reporting the story anyhow, the Obama administration may think it can deliver to Fox Media, to Rupert Murdoch, to NBC Universal, to Disney, and to CBS what the Bush administration could not: the legal license to lock down and monopolize the top 20 U.S. media markets by owning multiple radio, TV stations, and newspaper properties. What George W. Bush could not deliver for big media at the expense of the people, Barack Obama intends to. The U.S. political system channels almost all grassroots activism into electing corporate candidates. Most of the preachers and others who marshaled support for the president's reelection, all the while swearing to hold his feet to the fire, are off somewhere else right now, not paying attention, simply because the election is over and getting out the vote is all they ever do and all they've ever done. It's time for something old school, something completely different. If Dr. King were around today, he'd say it's time to make some noise, time to disobey some unjust laws until the law and things in general get better.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.